I think let us call our meeting to order. My name is Abdullah El Toman, Head of Department of Anthropology here. Unfortunately, one of our speakers has not been able to make it, and that is Jazzy Henrique. And well, what is good is that we have slightly more time for our two excellent speakers here. We start following the order here with Wesley Bound, who is from the Department of Art, Media, and American Studies.
Super School.
His talk is about it's a very long.
The title has changed.
Decimary and Modi, that will that change?
I'll explain when I
write it. Okay, that's fine. And then after that, we go to Gerald Maguire, one of our own here. He's a PhD candidate in the Department of Law, and he will talk about genocide by any other name, cultural genocide in the context of indigenous peoples. 35 minutes maximum, would that be?
Yeah.
Okay.
do weigh me down.
Okay.
And as I was saying, the title of my talk has changed since when I started for it. Since when I applied for the conference, but if anyone has any particular interest in multi-directional memory, do talk to me afterwards. So the name of this presentation is Testimony Becomes the Law, a pedagogical discussion of ethics in visual representations of trauma. In this presentation, I will consider a pedagogical argument regarding the place of ethics in representations of trauma. I will focus on two examples of visual historical archives: the documentary Shoah, France 1985, director Claude Lanzmann, and States of Fear, Ireland 1999, director Mary Raftery. Both documentaries received considerable attention upon release and influenced a large amount of public discourse relating to the events the documentaries focused on, namely testimonials by survivors of institutionalised violence. In the case of Shoah, the Nazi genocide of European Jews in occupied Europe during the Second World War. In States of Fear, the physical and sexual abuse of children under the state's care in orphanages and industrial homes in the years following the foundation of the Irish state. I will mainly focus on the differences in terms of approaching and presenting survivor testimonials via the methodology of the film's respective directors. However, one aspect of the shared legacies of Shoah and States of Fear in how in their placing of the values of survivor testimonies in order to understand the moral implications of traumatic events, these projects influenced the process of historical evaluation that shaped how institutionalized violence is memorialized in the contemporary world. In the case of Shoah, arguments made on moral grounds on how testimony is the singular, vital way of interpreting the Holocaust have abounded in Holocaust studies since the documentary's release. In the case of States of Fear, legal proceedings on behalf of the victims of institutionalized abuse emerged in the wake of the documentary screening on Ireland's state broadcaster, RTE. For my title, I reflect on Gillian Rose's critique of what she considered arguments claiming the inevitability of the Holocaust in philosophical discourse, that the events of the Jewish genocide in Europe are so magnanimous and unprecedented, it is beyond human capabilities of knowledge to allow these events to become representable. Attitudes of respectful silence and what Rose terms Holocaust piety permit a moralistic view of mourning the Holocaust victims without permitting them a voice to describe their experiences, a moralistic stance that refuses any means of historically coming to terms with events such as genocide, because according to Rose, it mystifies something that we dare not understand. Shoah and States of Fear, although documentaries which display vastly differing approaches in interviewing and presenting testimony, share a common objective in making traumatic experiences accessible to contemporary viewers. Efforts to investigate the nature of abuse on systematic levels show each documentary breaking through the silences previously associated with trauma in the 20th century, specifically those of abuse that was knowledge confined largely to state authorities. Both Shoah and States of Fear present testimony as paramount to interpreting historical memory, and both have influenced the most arguably humane outcome of historical research, the mediating of moral attitudes towards the rights of abuse survivors as justifiable. in using survivors' testimonies in order to understand what occurred in scenarios of institutional violence. These documentaries dare to explore what governments and citizens can do to ensure justice for those affected by lived traumatic experiences, and take steps to locate institutionalized violence as a major recurring narrative of 20th century history. Sure, authenticity and the auteur. So in this photograph we have Shoah's director, Claude Lanzmann, standing beside a poster advertising the film, and the poster's image is of Heinrich Gakowski, and Heinrich was a train driver who was given the job of transporting Jews to Treblinka. And I will talk later about how Lanzmann uses Poles in particular in the documentary to fulfill the role of bystanders, and how this view of Poles in the documentary comes out of a very existential view on inaction and other existentialist tropes that the film describes. So some background on Claude Lanzmann, 1925 to 2018. Born into a Jewish family in Paris, Lanzmann concealed his racial identity to the occupying German forces, and as a teenager fought in the French resistance. He became Jean-Paul Sartre's protégé and was chief editor at Le Temps Moderne from 1955 to 2016. He counted among his colleagues the editorial staff of influential French New Wave film journal Cahiers du Cinéma, which hailed Shoah as a cinematic masterpiece upon its release, and which gave the documentary extensive coverage. Lanzmann and his approach in the documentary is heavily influenced by Sartre's existentialist philosophy. Lanzmann transmits key concepts of Sartre's, such as the moral consequences of inaction, condemnation, shame, bad faith, and choiceless choices, into the directorial decisions made in Shoah. No one can understand what happened here, the destruction and provocation of memory in Shoah. With Shoah's documenting of over 300 hours of footage with survivors and of the Holocaust, and its depiction of the reforested areas of former concentration camps such as Chelmno and Treblinka, the film presents an incomparable historical archive, even as Lanzmann's heavily edited theatrical release of 556 minutes, roughly 9.5 hours. In an interview with French film journal Cahiers du Cinéma shortly after the film's release, Lanzmann describes the documentaries being whittled down from a vast archive of interviews and consciously cinematic reenactment materials that required 5 years of extensive planning and effort, with Lanzmann stating that much magnificent work ended up on the cutting room floor. The documentary's depiction of the reforested areas of mass murder and an insight into the secretive and euphemistic nature of the Nazis' final solution, the genocide of European Jewry, suggests an investigation into the attempted destruction of traumatic memory. However, Lanzmann consistently provokes traumatic episodes out of Holocaust survivors in order to understanding the meaning of the genocide, a process where dubious authorial approaches to historical research raise serious ethical questions. And in this scene that I will show, it is the opening of Shoah. So this is an example of one of the reenactments with the survivors. So this is the survivor, Simon Shrepka, and he was known as the singing boy of Chelmno. The Nazis would take him out on a boat to sing in order to keep them amused while they threw the remains of bodies into the river. Apologies for any distressing scenes that I show. So in this scene, Lanzmann gets Srebrenica to sit in the boat and reenact one of his experiences.
It's a reenactment.
It's a reenactment, yes. The film's opening scene is preempted by an action film style textual introduction stating, "The story begins." In the film's original French, this is rendered, "La action commence." The on-screen text insists on beginning the story of the Holocaust at the concentration camp Chelmno, where the first instances of the gassing of Jewish victims were recorded in December 1942. We are informed that ultimately 40,000 people lost their lives at Chelmno, and during the camp's liquidation, all remaining inmates were shot. Only two inmates survived to testify what they had endured at Chelmno. Simon Shrebnicka, who had become famous in the camp and the surrounding village of Chelmno as the singing boy the Germans would take on rowing expeditions in the nearby lake when they were dumping the ashes of human remains from the camp. As we have seen, Lanzmann chooses to open Shoah with a staged reenactment of Srebrenica, singing a Polish folk song in a rowboat on the lake. His sole companion, a rowing man dressed in black, who was facing away from the camera. As Matthew Boswell has written of this scene, Landsman here presents Srebrenica as the Odysseus descending with us on our journey into the underworld of the Holocaust. With the camera gradually moving in towards the emotionally moved, but also confused facial expressions of Srebrenica, this is the first of many shots that prioritises the aesthetic impact of a camera angle on viewers, as opposed to the spoken testimony and experiential engagement of the interview survivors. And they make the point that Srebrenica, in this shot, is the former singing boy of Chelmno as he descends again into traumatic experience. Landsman's aestheticization of trauma. In the following scene, where Srebrenica encounters his first view of Chelmno since he first fled the camp in 1945, Landsman reinstates a sense of awkward confusion with his subject via his insistence of a lingering shot of Srebrenica approaching the field where the burning of bodies occurred. Landsman can also be seen in Srebrenica's path and putting himself in frame of shot, a non-witness who seems to be strangely smiling at the sight of a field where mass killing had taken place. Srebrenica's testimony to the ineffable acts of human slaughter that occurred at Chelmno, no one can understand what happened here, are furthermore drowned out by Landsman's aesthetic cinema variété camera angles. The overhead shot of the field with Srebrenica walking alongside the cement burial ground was clearly painstaking in its setup, yet Srebrenica's testimony continues on, dubbed in the studio in post-production. In a documentary where witness and the crucial nature of testimony are insisted as bearing such a central narrative concern, Landsman's affected attempts at authenticity through reenactments and the developments of his own artistic sensibilities have sure demonstrated its director's often problematic combinations of aesthetics, philosophy and morality. Shaw in this way shows the aestheticization of traumatic experience. And I'll just quickly show you the instance of that scene now. So this is Srebrenica approaching the camp. And note the often awkward gaze of the camera on Srebrenica's face and his confused reaction to this camera in his face when he's seeing the camp where he's imprisoned with for the first time in 40 years. And this is Landsman entering the shot about here. And this is what I mean by the aesthetic shot that took a couple of hours to set up. The selection process of survivor testimonies by Landsman infers an uncomfortable resemblance to how the selection process at concentration camps, which were lived experiences of the survivors, took place on arrival at the camps. Furthermore, Landsman's selection of Simon Srebrenica and Mordechai Potelnik, who had both previously given testimony at Adolf Eichmann's trial in Jerusalem in 1963, is made on the basis that they present the strongest cases in terms of the emotional impact resulted by the extremely tragic and often macabre experiences they faced in Chelmno. Experiences that highlight a particularly evil cynicism and barbarity on behalf of the perpetrators at the camp. Landsman also had prior knowledge that both these interviewees survived Chelmno because of their work as Sonderkommandos, what the Germans nicknamed secret keepers, members of the camp's special units, able-bodied Jewish inmates who were given the option of living longer in exchange for working the gas chamber detail, so leading people into the gas chambers and assuring them that they would be reassigned housing afterwards. Srebrenica and Potelnik both shared a profound guilt at their roles in assisting the genocide of Jews at Chelmno. This is Mordechai Potelnik. Potelnik, whose episode of fainting at the Eichmann trial had proven one of the most emotionally intense moments of emergent Holocaust testimony captured on screen, is shown as telling Landsman he smiles to forget, resisting Landsman's interrogative provocation to share his experiences on camera for the second time. In the following scene, which I declined to feature in the presentation because of the seriousness of the levels of Potelnik's distress on screen, Landsman directly asks how Potelnik felt the first time he saw gassed victims. Potelnik states he cried, and when admitting this, he begins to emotionally break down and weep on screen. As Landsman's camera zooms in on his distraught face, Potelnik states, on the second day working as a Sonderkommando, he saw the bodies of his wife and children piled in the chamber. And Landsman asks him a further three times how this made him feel, to which he replied, "I buried them and begged the Germans to kill me." And then Landsman pushes on. They told me I was too strong and had to continue working. At no point at this stage of the interview does Landsman offer respite for Potemnik, or does he direct to adjust the camera away from MP's pleading, tear-filled eyes. It is one of several scenes in Soa where Landsman interrogates an emotional breakdown during the filming of testimony, where he commands the camera in close-up. Soa as existential rhetoric. Landsman cinematically deconstructs the limits of language, choice, responsibility, and fate found in Sartre's work written contemporaneous with the Holocaust and its immediate aftermath, and still popularly associated with Sartre and existentialism in general. And that's from a paper by Jay Geller on the rights of responsibility, the cinematic rhetoric of Claude Landsman Soa, which highlights the influence on Landsman's directorial decision in Soa as being one of an existentialist methodology. As much as we are condemned to be free in Landsman's existential approach to making sense of the Jewish genocide perpetrated by the Nazis, we the audience are condemned to bear witness to events that we are told from the outset we cannot understand. These ethical questions raised by Landsman's methodologies do not diminish the documentary or film's legacy. Soa was an integral source of inspiration for the memorialization and museumification of sites where former concentration camps stood. In this way, the film helped to reclaim the destruction of memory, of history and memory, sorry, attempted by the Nazis during the Holocaust. Treblinka, in particular, would have been largely written out of history, as the Nazis destroyed all documents relating to the camp, and like Telmo, only a handful of survivors emerged alive from Treblinka out of the hundreds of thousands sent there. The film received a rapturous reception in France, where Mitterrand attended the screening of the original 9.5-hour cut in 1986, prompting public discourse on the Holocaust for the first time in France. The film has a 100% rating on Rotten Tomatoes and has had such an influence on Holocaust studies. The authority with which Landsman's project is discussed reflects the kind of moralised language of authentic approaches to representing trauma which Landsman displays throughout the film. In this way, a self-fulfilling prophecy, rare indeed in documentary filmmaking, and arguably rare in a historical narrative, occur. And I will now turn to States of Fear. And States of Fear, the Institution, Violence Against the Child and Modern Memory in the Republic of Ireland is the title of this section. So I will begin by giving you some background on States of Fear. Commissioned by the Irish National Broadcaster, RTE, and transmitted between April and May of 1999, States of Fear focuses on the testimonies of survivors of physical and sexual abuse in state and church-run institutions such as St. Joseph's Orphanage in Kilkenny. The events of abuse detailed in the series occurred in the immediate aftermath after the foundation of the independent Irish state, and reported incidents ranged from the 1930s to the 1970s. And the series represents a long-term project of investigative journalist Mary Afferty, 1957 to 2012. And just notice from Ed Watt's testimony how the camera is set up at a respective angle. There's no director interlocution into the interview. He's allowed to say his testimony as he wishes to, and then the scene cuts to another interviewee talking about St. Joseph's. So this scene was set up in order to just display testimony and not to provoke Ed. And in this sense, you could argue the pedagogical, the methodology around this is somewhat more ethical than Landsman's. And there's also ethical questions raised in the aftermath of States of Fear. This is a quote from Mary Afferty. Victims of abuse. So, ignorance in the abuse suffered by orphan boys at St. Joseph's. The idea is that the incidents took place hidden in plain sight in the compound of Kilkenny's Social Services Division. Lead solicitor Michael Lanigan to stress the ethical importance of providing legal justice for the survivors of institutional abuse in Ireland. What we should have done and what we need to do is the outcome of his viewing of the documentary. So we need to make a legal case for the rights of abuse survivors in Ireland. In this way, testimony did become the law, as I will now explain. So, ethical concerns raised in the aftermath of States of Fear. This is a quote from Mary Afferty. Thousands of victims of abuse look to the investigation into child abuse in Ireland for the ultimate vindication of the truth of the trauma they suffered as children. Equally, the religious orders that ran the schools and children's institutions under inquiry hope that it will provide a balance by validating their own testimony of the good work they did for children who, they argue, would otherwise have been destitute. And just note the moralised language that the church's response uses. Again, it's a question of morality. It isn't a question of talking about the actual abuses. It's a question of, well, if we didn't take the children in, what would have happened to them then? No account of the church's failings are ever admitted by the church, even after the inquiry was released, even after Bertie Ahern's official state apology. So it's interesting to think about this idea of mourning and silence there. I mean, bad things happened, but if it wasn't for us, ellipsis. And there was a case of a miscarriage of justice against Nora Wall, who was wrongly convicted of rape in 2009. Her case stretches back to the 90s, and it sparked concerns that the documentary may have incited false allegations of abuse. Wall was the only woman in the state's history to be convicted via evidence based on repressed memory methodology, which again kind of brings up this idea of psychoanalysis and existentialist and psychoanalytical understandings of trauma as opposed to like real testimonials. And in conclusion, in Shoah and States of Fear, survivors of institutional violence deliver testimonies that act as invaluable historical evidence. Both documentaries have proved the basis for arguments for changes in law regarding the legal rights of abuse survivors internationally. Both documentaries raise important ethical issues in the methodologies they apply and the nature of understanding of the importance of historical testimony. And I will leave by saying that writing this paper was quite difficult, and in the era when a head of government is openly mocking testimony of abuse, it was, the ethical questions were concerned seemed quite palpable, but again, this kind of same issue of representation is happening, and the same issue about how some states confirm testimony to a second level rather than the first level kind of form of understandings of events of historical abuse. Morality seems to be the main line throughout most of these responses to genocide and other historical abuses. But the main point I want to look at this is like, how do we explain to students that sometimes testimony can become legalistic term? So thank you very much, and thanks for listening.